Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, there are primaries today, I know, but there's a whole wide world of economic news out there, you know, and we have got it from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 15th of March. Great as always to have you along, everybody. Quick, what did Calvin Coolidge and Barack Obama have in common? Anybody? No? All right, I'll give it to you. When the president lands in Havana next week, he'll be the first sitting American president to visit Cuba since Coolidge did it in 1928. In advance of his trip today, the White House announced more easing of the restrictions that Washington's had in place on economic ties with Cuba the past 50 years. They will, in theory, make it easier for individuals to go and to do business there. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, who you hear every now and then on Fridays on this program in our weekly wrap, has family in Cuba. He is back not too long ago from his second visit the past couple of months. So we got him on the phone to tell us what it's like. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So second trip, right?
Second trip to Cuba.
When you got off the plane, what was it like? Was it, we're ready for, you know, the United States to come here, or are they not ready?
You know, it's a little tough to say. I mean, it's clear right now that Cuba wants the investment, they want the tourism, they need the revenues. But at the same time, the infrastructure upgrade is coming along very slowly. The business environment in Cuba is still very soft, it's very weak. I'm quite certain that they really welcome this opening, but at the same time, they're going through it with quite a bit of wariness.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the Cuban population certainly is excited about it, possibly more so than the Cuban government.
Give me the nuts and bolts. When you got to your hotel, could you do credit card transactions? Was there Wi-Fi in the rooms? I mean, those things that Western visitors will expect. And we should say Europeans have been coming there the whole time that Americans haven't.
So I didn't actually stay in a hotel. No. I stayed in a casa particular. That, by the way, is roughly Cuban for bed and breakfast.
Got it.
Cuba has a network of private homes that are allowed to rent their rooms to visitors, essentially tourists. And they need it because the tourism boom there has been quite impressive in the last few years, and there isn't the hotel capacity to deal with it. Some of them are allowed internet access because they are businesses. But remember that internet is not allowed in the homes, and it's only very gradually being allowed to be accessed in other places. So the infrastructure there, again, is quite bad. It's quite inconvenient. But at the same time, people want to see Cuba before it changes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you go out to dinner, are you paying cash or are you putting down your Visa?
Cash every time. My credit cards aren't going to work in Cuba. Most places in Cuba don't accept credit cards. And so one of the inconveniences of traveling to Cuba for Americans in particular is that you need to have enough cash on hand to last the entire trip, or you're going to run into some serious problems.
Give me the export-import calculation, both how ready you think businesses are there to trade with the United States and then your perception of American businesses knowing what they're getting into.
Well, some American businesses have been exempt from the embargo all along, so agriculture, telecommunications. For other businesses, I think they're going to be surprised to find that the regulations on the Cuban side, forget the U.S. side, but on the Cuban side, are still really quite stringent. So right now, for instance, when you invest in Cuba, it has to be in a joint partnership with the government and in a minority stake. So the government still takes the majority stake. You have very limited access in terms of dealing with your own employees and even paying them. So Cuba is very slowly rewriting its investment laws, and it's established this new economic zone that's trying to attract new investment and where the rules are a little bit more favorable to foreign companies. And so there's some reason to be optimistic and excited about what's happening in Cuba, but I think it's going to be a slow grinding process. It is still a very profoundly bureaucratic place, especially for businesses.
Cardiff Garcia writes for the blog FT Alphaville. He is on our air every couple of 3 weeks or so on a Friday. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, a little bumpy, mostly to the downside. Everybody's pretty much waiting for Fed Chair Janet Yellen's press conference tomorrow. We will have the details when we do the numbers. I say bend the cost curve. The health policy aficionados among you know exactly what I'm talking about. The idea that was, to be clear, a key White House talking point during the healthcare debate, that we kind of have to change the rate at which healthcare costs are rising in this economy. On that note, this, the growth rate of what we all paid for prescription drugs slowed dramatically last year. We'd all be paying a whole lot more if it wasn't for generics. They account for as much as 85% of all the meds that we take. The Food and Drug Administration wants to make sure consumers have as many generic choices as possible. So to that end, it's going to prioritize any generic drug application when there's currently just one manufacturer making the drug in question, the name brand drug in question, I guess I should say. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more on that.
In about a year, the heart medication Isupro went from $50 a dose to $1,800. A drug pharmacist Aaron Fox says University of Utah Healthcare had always stocked on crash carts.
Basically, it's kind of what you might see on TV, that, you know, code blue, cardiac arrest, everyone's rushing around. You might administer this to try to help with that.
Truly life-saving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can be.
At $1,800 a dose, it got pulled off the carts, only to be used in extreme emergencies. This is what happens when a company has a lock on a given drug. Some estimate there are 500 generic drugs for everything from cancer to multiple sclerosis to heart disease that currently have virtual monopolies. And companies like Valeant and Turing have taken advantage.
This is a good circumstance of the FDA actually getting out in front of the problem before it becomes serious. And I think this is a program that I believe is really going to have significant impact.
Peter Pitts is a former associate FDA commissioner. Pitts hopes cutting the application process from 2 to 3 years to as short as 6 months will help clamp down on some of the price gouging. Former industry CEO George Zorich wonders if that's enough of an incentive.
If I'm a manufacturer, I'm hard-pressed just to drop everything without some real frank discussions with them.
Several major generic manufacturers and the industry trade group declined interview requests. In statements, several simply said competition is important, perhaps an indication that speeding up the FDA process is just one of several steps needed to drive more competition. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Avon is one of those quintessentially American brands, yeah? So it's news that the company is moving to the UK. All right, before you go there, though, Avon says this is not, repeat, not one of those tax avoidance schemes, what have come to be called corporate inversions. The company says it's moving to cut expenses as it tries to rehabilitate its beleaguered business. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on why Avon needs a makeover.
In the 50s and 60s, Avon, which is focused mostly on women's cosmetics, ran commercials with this catchphrase.
Avon calling.
Today, that door-to-door model is pretty outdated.
You know, Avon would come calling and there'd be no one home.
Barbara Kahn is a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. No one home, Kahn says, because more women today are working. Compound that with increased competition online.
There is a lot of these subscription services, Birchbox, where you get a box of cosmetics to try at home.
The result is 4 years of falling sales at Avon. But internationally, it's a different story. Avon CEO Sherry McCoy, speaking recently on CNBC, said the brand is doing better overseas.
We are still growing our representative base. So women are still coming in. They love the products. They want the earnings opportunity. And so if you look at the health of the brand, it's still very strong.
So Avon is now solely focused overseas. It sold its North American business to a private equity firm, and it's reducing costs, cutting 2,500 jobs and moving its headquarters to the UK to combine with existing operations there. J.P. Eggers is an associate professor of management and organizations at NYU.
If most of the organization's operations are no longer U.S.-based, then realistically being closer to where most of their operations are should allow them to achieve some efficiencies.
One thing Avon says it's not doing is avoiding American taxes. The company will stay registered in the U.S. and will continue to trade on the New York Stock Exchange. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
We're out with the second wave of our Marketplace Edison Research poll this week, how you're feeling about the economy and why. One of the questions we asked this time was about gas prices and how much cheap gas is helping you personal economy-wise. Overall, more than a quarter of people said it's helping a lot. So we sent Marketplace's Andy Euler off to find out where that money that people is saving is going.
I ended up chatting with Diane Lim, you know, because she understands this stuff as Vice President of Economic Research at the Committee for Economic Development in D.C. And you know what she told me she did the last time she got gas?
I posted on Facebook.
That's right. She took a picture of the price per gallon, $1.03, and ended up filling her tank for less than $10.
Just like I share, you know, excitement over other things in my life, I said, hey, this is a postable moment.
It's one of those moments, even if you're an economist who studies these things. Lim also says this sort of savings is a lot different than, say, your income tax return because it's immediate. Gas prices are in your face every time you drive. So you essentially comparison shop while you're getting to where you're going.
Because it comes in small amounts every day, people are more likely to spend it in small amounts every day on other things. So, you know, maybe they buy an extra Starbucks coffee, or maybe they buy another drink during happy hour.
But Lim says she'd be cautious declaring that people are spending the money they're saving on gas on things like going out to eat. There's been a general trend of people spending more money on eating out for years, especially among young people. Lim also admits that she's in a good spot herself and doesn't really have to worry about money. But a lot of the folks who participated in our poll do. Almost 40% of the young people we talked to said lower gas prices helped them out a lot. Glenn Garris is a 22-year-old hotel bellboy in Phoenix, Arizona. He gets paid by the hour, makes a little more than minimum wage. He and his girlfriend live with his parents.
With the budget around everything we want to do, we want to go on trips, but then we have to see how much it's going to cost altogether before we can actually start planning to take the trip. So it kind of makes it a little bit harder on minimum wage.
Garris says he notices gas savings because he can actually do more things and enjoy his road trips. More hourly employees, compared with those who work on salary, said lower gas prices help their budgets a lot. Jerome Cullison is 29 and works for a landscaping company in Phoenix. He says he drives about 30 miles to work every day, so it directly affects the money he takes home.
I'm just a regular person that does a daily job. So I get paid to get there, do my job, and then leave. If you can't afford gas, how are you supposed to get to work? $4 a gallon compared to $2 for a gallon of gas is a big, huge difference. You know, I'm just a normal, average American.
Depending on how you get paid and how you get there makes a big difference in what low gas prices mean for a normal, average American. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've got all the data from our poll on our website, of course. Drill down to your heart's content. And while you're there, do us a favor and take our quiz, sort of an online version of the poll. See where you fall on our economic anxiety index. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Every mall that open, I just feel that we have lost another opportunity to do something different.
One person's shopping mall is another person's economic divide. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 22 points today, about a 10%, ended at 17,251. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.4%, 4728. The S&P 500 gave up 3 points, 0.1%, 2015. Valeant Pharmaceuticals was pretty much designed to be a corporate shark, a drug company whose real product was profits. Then high drug prices became news, and so today Valeant reported a loss. It forecast lower everything and warned it could default on its debt. Valeant down 51% today, down 87% since its peak. Being for sale is good for share prices. That would be Mead Johnson Nutrition. Makes infant formula, up 11% today. Bond prices were flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note, thus also flat, 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So here is one of those paradoxes upon which capitalism thrives. Sony is going to give Michael Jackson's estate $750 million in return for the 50% of the Sony ATV music publishing company that it doesn't already own. The deal gives Sony ownership of works by Bob Dylan, Eminem, Taylor Swift, and even after all these years, the musical equivalent of a sure thing, the Beatles catalog. So here with the paradox, the music publishing business clearly remains lucrative even when the music industry itself is kind of struggling. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on that one.
I read the news today and I couldn't stop my mind from wandering. Why? Why pay $750 million for a music catalog?
Important unrealized asset sometimes in this business is really music publishing, which is the ownership of a song copyright. as opposed to the recordings that we sometimes are more familiar with.
Paul Young teaches music industry studies at USC's Thornton School of Music. He says if money is what you want out of the music industry, there are a lot of potential revenue streams for a publisher.
You're giving permission to use a song to a not just a record company, but to a radio station, to a TV company.
Transactions that are far less threatened by music's digital revolution. Consider the show Mad Men. It reportedly paid $250,000 in licensing fees to use the Beatles song Tomorrow Never Knows. Jeff Jample is the president of Jam Inc., which manages musicians and their estates. He says publishing catalogs are attractive for a couple of reasons.
It's easy to see what they've done for the last 10, 20, 30 years.
And he says catalogs tend to hold their value many years from now. They can offer solid returns, getting better all the time. Sure, money can't buy me love, but it might offer Sony a steady income stream. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
With a nod to Donald Rumsfeld, and yes, I fully appreciate the irony of what I'm about to say here, but sometimes there really are unknown unknowns, stuff you don't know that you don't know. Staying in the national security realm here for a second, nowhere is that more true than when you start talking cyber warfare. Who can do what to whom and how? And one of the things you'll learn in a new book from Fred Kaplan, it's called Dark Territory, is how new and how turbulent the history of cyber warfare is. Fred, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
I need you to start literally at the beginning of the book. 1983, Ronald Reagan's in the White House, and he sees a movie.
Right. He's up at Camp David the first weekend of June. He watches on a Saturday night War Games. Remember the movie with Matthew Broderick? He plays this tech whiz teenager who unwittingly hacks into the main computer at the North American Air Defense Command, thinking he's playing a new online game. Almost starts World War III. So the following Wednesday, Reagan is back in the White House. He's talking, he has a big national security meeting about a different topic completely, but at one point he puts down his index cards and he says, has anybody seen this movie War Games? And then he turns to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and says, General, could something like this really happen? And the general says, I'll look into that, Mr. President, as generals are wont to do. And he comes back a week later and says, Mr. President, the problem is much worse than you think. And that leads, a year later, to the first presidentially signed directive on computer security.
And then we are off and running in a series of fits and starts to the present day. But I guess that's my point, that it goes and it stops, and it goes and it stops, kind of depending on who's in the White House and who's the director of national intelligence and at the CIA. And there's no coherence, it seems, over the past 40 years.
Right. Well, after this directive, the directive was taken over by the NSA.
The National Security Agency, the
wiretap. Yeah, the National Security Agency, which was supposed to just do foreign intelligence. It put them in charge of setting standards for computers in America. This was resisted by the Congress for good reason, but then the whole thing fell apart, and then it came back in the 90s when there were some real hacks, but then people lost interest with 9/11, and then it came back with where we are today. But the point is that the issues were understood, at least by certain people, 35 years ago, and yet we've made very little progress in dealing with the fundamental issues since.
One of the things you mention, at some point in the late 90s, early 2000s, it becomes completely apparent that private corporations, and this is your line, private companies control the pathways of cyberspace. That is, the switching stations and all the rest of it. And so the private sector has to be involved in the policy.
Right. And there were people in the White House who wanted to impose mandatory security standards, at least on critical infrastructure. But this was resisted by lobbyists, by the companies, and even by cabinet officials who thought this might impede research and development and make these companies less competitive. So because of this strange situation where we have so much that's in the public interest and that affects civilization wrapped up with private corporations, it's just never really gotten off the ground.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Fred. I want to give a nod to the title of this book, Dark Territory. It's a line from former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, whose dad, I guess, was a train station master or something.
Grandfather,
but,
yeah.
But you come back to it at the very end where you talk about how we don't know what we don't know about cyber warfare and how problematical that is.
Well, yeah, Robert Gates, he became Secretary of Defense. He's getting these briefings about how we're getting hacked every day. And he said, we're wandering in dark territory. Dark territory, it turns out, was used by the American railroad companies to designate a stretch of railroad track that's ungoverned by signals. So that's kind of where we're at. We have an entire military command set up, U.S. Cyber Command. And yet the most basic questions are just now getting asked, much less answered. And yet this whole war machine really is up and not just ready to go, but doing things on a very secret basis.
The book by Fred Kaplan, who's the national security columnist at Slate, is called Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's been said often here and elsewhere in the business press that the modern American shopping mall is a relic of economic days gone by, that they just don't make money like they used to. True enough, here, but in developing countries, there's a mall building boom going on. On the face of it, a sign that the wheels of commerce are turning as they should. Locals, though, don't always see things that way. Alex Schmidt reports now from Mexico City.
The new Oasis Shopping Center rises out of the leafy cobblestone neighborhood of Coyoacán. Its sharp architectural lines, decorative pools, and modern planters are impressive. So impressive that people stop in just for photos. Vanya Cruz and her friend pose in front of an artificial waterfall during their visit from the town of Cuernavaca.
The mall is beautiful. It's huge. It's very elegant. I like it a lot.
In 2015, 16 malls like this went up around Mexico City. And this year, even more are in the works. But not everyone is so enthusiastic.
Every mall that opened, I just feel that we have lost another opportunity to do something different.
Roberto Remes is an activist and urban planning consultant in Mexico City. He believes the malls destroy informal economies, raise rents, create more traffic. And he worries about spaces that heighten inequality.
People do not realize that this is not a public space. Probably a person poor enough doesn't think to be here. That's part of the freedom that we lose with malls.
On a weekday at Oasis, people mill around the huge open space. Two visiting students from the Yucatan have stopped in to get some food. Luis Garcia Villanueva says he's not a fan. He calls the mall ostentatious with its fancy stores like Cole Haan and Calvin Klein.
I feel a bit uncomfortable because we just came to eat something and you see all the rest of it and we can't afford to shop here.
Nigeria, China, and Colombia are just a few of the countries where sleek commercial spaces are in the works. The trend makes sense, says Arlene Davila. She's an anthropology professor at NYU who just wrote a book about the global shopping center boom.
You have cheaper lands, easier conditions for getting permits. You have lax urban planning conditions.
The ease with which malls get approved isn't a bad thing to some. Jorge Lizan is a shopping center consultant who advises mall projects around the world. He sees them as public-private partnerships that improve countries.
These big chains are able to provide lower prices than an informal market, but also they improve the quality of life of these communities. They provide a place for the people to gather, to socialize.
You're talking about a privately led public policy becoming the de facto way in which people are organizing cities.
Again, anthropology professor Arlene Davila.
Who has access to deciding how our communities and how our cities should run when you have mega developments that are basically unchecked, right, making all the decisions?
Activists like Roberto Remes are fighting back.
I think that we need to change the rules.
This past December, Remes helped lead the first successful campaign against a major commercial project in Mexico City. But for now, in countries the world over, there will be no shortage of mall selfie opportunities. In Mexico City, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a public service announcement of sorts to those traveling to Washington, D.C. tomorrow. It's just one word. Here it is. don't. The Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, the Metro as it's called, announced this afternoon it's going to shut down the city's subway system starting at midnight tonight. Shut it all the way down for at least 24 hours. System-wide safety inspections are the proximate cause. There was a big electrical fire on Monday, so it does make sense, but yeesh. Also, any guesses on the Uber surge pricing multiple tomorrow? Anybody? All right, got to go. The Dow up 22 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gave up 3 points, a 0.1%. Don't forget Janet Yellen tomorrow. She's taking questions and answers, hopefully. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.